to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, an airman's perspective. Executing air, space, and cyber power to fly, fight, and win in the Pacific with General Howie Chandler. General Chandler entered the Air Force in 1974 after graduating from the United States Air Force Academy. Serving around the world, including tours of the Pacific, Southern Europe, the Middle East, and the United States, the General has commanded a numbered Air Force, two fighter wings, a support group, and a fighter squadron. As commander of the 11th Air Force, he served in Alaska from 2002 to 2005. Prior to assuming his current position, he was Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, Plans, and Requirements at the U.S. Air Force Headquarters. The General is a command pilot with over 3,900 hours of flying in T-38s, F-15s, and F-16s. He was promoted to General in November 2007 and has been serving as the Commander of the United States Pacific Air Force's Air Component Commander for Pacific Command. On Friday, January 9th, students from South Anchorage High School's ROTC program gathered to hear General Howie Chandler speak about executing air, space, and cyber power to fly, fight, and win in the Pacific. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents An Airman's Perspective with General Howie Chandler.
Well, first let me say thank you. It certainly is nice to be back in Anchorage and in Alaska. It's nice to see so many familiar faces. Also nice to see our ROTC cadets here today. Nice of you to bring them out, and we're hoping they can take something away other than the fact they were forced to come and listen to the general talk at lunch. Other than that, maybe we got you out of school for just a bit, so maybe there's a plus on this somewhere. When Lisa offered me the opportunity to do this, it was an exciting opportunity for me, quite honestly, because this particular group of people understands the size and the scope of what we deal with every day in the Pacific, at Pacific Air Forces or at Pacific Command, in my job working for Admiral Keating. Now, I chose an airman's perspective because that's what I do. My Navy friends will look at the perspective of the Pacific and the fact that it covers the Pacific Theater and the fact that it covers half the world's surface and say, you know, 90% of that is covered by water. The Army folks I know like to weigh in about boots on the ground and a certain percentage of land in the Pacific. Airmen tend to believe that 100% of the Pacific is covered by air, quite honestly. But I would tell you that, quite honestly, it does not matter what it's covered with if you do not have the forces and the persistent presence that you need in the places where we need it around the Pacific. It frankly could be covered with green cheese, and it really wouldn't matter. And I think that's the takeaway, and I'll give you to that. I will give you that, pardon me, right up front, that we are where we are in the Pacific today because of the security agreements, the economic agreements, the underpinnings that have been provided that allow us to do the things we do in the Pacific, and in fact, the United States is a Pacific nation. Now, physically large, yes. Economically large, absolutely. About half the world's gross domestic product is now produced in the Pacific. That includes the United States. The Pacific Rim rivals the output, economic output of the Pacific Rim rivals the output of the United States itself. It also rivals the output of the European Union. So it's not only large in size, it's economically important, I think, to the entire globe. And we're seeing that today with what's going on in the world. So I would simply start with that. I have very few slides. I'd like to get through these as quickly as I can and then offer an opportunity for some questions, if I may. I start with what we think about every day at Pacific Air Forces. We spend a lot of time ensuring that we have the forces when and where we need them. As I said in the beginning, it really doesn't matter if 100% of the Pacific is covered by air. If you don't have airmen there and you don't have the capabilities you need in place, it really doesn't matter. And we spend a lot of time doing that. You can see where our Air Force is putting its priorities today. Today we have two of the only overseas assigned C-17 units in the Pacific, one here at Elmendorf, the other at Hickam. Today we're programmed to have three of the currently programmed F-22 F-22 squadrons. Three of those will be in the Pacific, two here at Elmendorf and one at Hickam. So we're spending a lot of time and effort posturing forces to be able to do what we need to do in terms of air power capabilities in the Pacific, and we'll talk a little bit more about space as well. Our obvious job is to prepare for immediate combat response should be required to do that. I would also add to that, if you have those capabilities, you also have a very unique capability for disaster relief and humanitarian responses, which we find ourselves doing, unfortunately, fairly regularly in this part of the world. And in its own strange way, I would tell you that it has actually started to bring some of the countries in the Pacific closer together. In the past, we did a lot of bilateral arrangements and cooperation. Today, you're seeing more and more multilateral cooperation in the Pacific. And in large part, as again, I would tell you, if there's anything to come out of some of the tremendous disasters that we've seen in the Pacific, is that a number of Pacific nations are working together to help solve those crises. Every day, we're about promoting regional security and stability. If we can do that today, it may well, in fact, prevent a fight tomorrow. So we spend a lot of time with a lot of countries around the Pacific, working with their air forces, training with their air forces, and exchanging information. There's a large part of that that goes on here in Alaska in terms of Red Flag and the Pacific Alaska Range Complex, as well as some of the other activities that I'll talk about on one of the slides. And, of course, taking care of our folks is a big deal. I need to tell you thank you for the way you embrace the airmen of this community and throughout the state of Alaska. This is a highly sought-after assignment for a number of reasons, and one of those reasons is the way you take care of the young men and women that come here. So let me thank you up front for that. A lot of things that are shaping what we do. We are going to deal with China in the future. It's going to happen. Whether we see a peaceful rising China or something other than peaceful is going to be determined in large part by how we react today. My personal opinion is, and having dealt with some of the Chinese individuals that are my counterparts, that are the airmen that are across the Straits of Taiwan today, I would tell you that it's a very interesting phenomenon to watch. In the case of the Chinese snowstorms and the Chinese earthquake, where we were able to load C-17s, one of which was from Elmendorf, with humanitarian relief and deliver it within 36 hours, you get a great deal of thanks for doing that. And they tell you, as they sit across the table, they will tell you, we'll never forget you, and we'll never forget what you did for us. The next thing they will ask is, how did you do that so quickly? And I would also tell you that's a pretty good thing for them to be wondering about, too, quite honestly. But I think overall, I agree with Admiral Keating, and we'll basically speak for him here in saying that we are cautiously optimistic about our relationship with the Chinese. The recent arms sales to Taiwan has cut off some of the relations and some of the exchanges that we had planned, but I would tell you that it was less of a reaction than we've seen in the past to arms sales for Taiwan. And typically when you sit down with the Chinese, you have the exchange about Taiwan, and then you get on with the rest of the business that you want to conduct. Unlike the old days when most of the exchange did nothing other than discuss Taiwan. So I would tell you that that relationship is one that we need to be cautiously optimistic about, and one that, frankly, from my position, we need to be able to deal with the Chinese from a position of strength. My personal opinion, when the PACAF commander has to sit down and look at his Chinese counterpart across the table, and his Chinese counterpart is more interested in being belligerent than he is about talking, then we will start to have problems. Today, we're able to deal with the Chinese from a position of strength in the Pacific. We discussed improved regional cooperation, all the things that I have listed on the slide that have caused us to come together in the Pacific. North Korea is an interesting phenomena. A declining reliance on conventional forces, and now a reliance on a nuclear capability. Chances are the world would not pay a lot of attention to the North Koreans today if they did not have nuclear weapons. We'll continue to deal with that. And I think what you'll continue to see is six-party talks that give us 2 to 3 steps forward, and then we'll take 1 to 2 steps back. And that's the way the relationship has been. The new Republic of Korea government has taken more of a carrot-and-stick approach than the last administration. The new administration in the Republic of Korea has also embraced the United States a little more warmly in terms of our relationship and the way they deal with us and the way we're working our forces on the peninsula. And as most of you know, we're in the process of drawing down on the Korean Peninsula. We'll have about 28,500 combination of airmen and soldiers on the peninsula itself, and we're transforming that agreement from, or that arrangement militarily, from what I would consider to be a Cold War arrangement to one that is more in line with what we need to do here in the 21st century, and I think it's the right thing to do. So far as we're also looking at extending family members' tours in Korea and normalizing, if you will, to use the term, rotations into Korea for members in their family. Today, over 90% of our airmen there are there without their families. On a one-year remote tour, we'd like to see that change, and we think we have the opportunity to do that. Continued growth of economic liberalization. The slide says democratization. I would tell you that word can be inflammatory. Representative government is probably a little better word. I stole this slide from PACOM, by the way, so I didn't change a slide. But you need to understand that throughout the Pacific, there is, in fact, an embracing of representative government and economic liberalization, which in turn has helped us. And again, I go back to the fact that I think that was underpinned in large part by the relationships that we've built since the end of World War II. And when I say we, I don't just mean the military. I mean the government-to-government relationships and those other relationships that continue that persistent presence, if you will, that have gotten us to where we are in the Pacific. You will continue to see resource competition. You'll see that up close and personal in the Arctic, quite honestly, not just in the South China Sea, where we read about it in the newspapers, but as the Arctic opens, and I know, Karen, from a Canadian standpoint, Canada is paying a tremendous amount of attention to the Northwest Passage. Our Coast Guard is going to have to pay a tremendous amount of attention to the Northwest Passage near the American coastline. It will present different issues for homeland defense and national security when you have cruise ships and other vessels that are now able to transit the Northwest Passage, and then also the resources in terms of minerals and fisheries and petroleum and all those things that we see. We see that up close and personal here in Alaska, obviously, with Russian long-range aviation and the things that we deal with in the outer air defense identification zone here in Alaska itself. I am very optimistic about the war on terror and the way it's going in the Pacific. And I go back to, and I will probably say this more than once again, the fact that there is an alternative in the Pacific to something other than a hopeless lifestyle. That has allowed us to do some things in the Philippines, for example, that have, for the most part, marginalize those people that would be al-Qaeda wannabes or al-Qaeda associates or other groups, and has basically turned them into a bunch of thieves and thugs. Not a lot of sympathy, because there are other alternatives in the Philippines to that way of life. And frankly, I think we all understand, whether you're in the military or otherwise, that that is how we solve this problem. You know, we simply can't kill everybody in the world that would go down this particular path. You have to offer them another alternative, and there has to be a different way to do business. We've talked about how big it is. That's about 3 million square miles. The rest of the Pacific is about 100 million square miles. This is who we are. 4 numbered air forces, 9 major wings. We're located at several different operating locations, but 40,000 total force personnel, and I emphasize total force personnel. We probably have some Alaska Guardsmen in the audience. Nowhere in my career have I had the opportunity to work more closely with the Guard and Reserve than here in Alaska or in Hawaii. And frankly, as I grew up as a young captain, we used the Guard and Reserve when we had something we needed to deal with that had everybody else busy. Today, they're an integral part of what we do. You can see that in the weapon systems that they work in and the way we're organized on the base. We have a C-17 unit that's composed of both guardsmen and active duty personnel. We have an F-22 squadron that will be composed of active duty personnel as well as reservists. So we're working hand in hand throughout the Pacific. The same is true in Hawaii. The same is true in Guam. Today, 11th Air Force is responsible for Eielson and Elmendorf. I don't have to explain that to you. The mission is simply the throughput of forces through and from the continental United States and Alaska across the northern route of the Pacific to the Asia Theater. The 13th Air Force is located at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. They manage Anderson and Hickam. Their mission is the throughput of forces through and from the United States and Hawaii across the Southern Pacific. And, of course, on the Korean Peninsula, Osan and Kunsan Air Base, that are there in response to what the way we have been postured since the end of the Korean War. And then, of course, Yokota, Kadena, and Misawa are there in a supporting role to support what goes on in the Western Pacific as well. We describe what we call the strategic triangle between Alaska, Hawaii, and Guam. And I would tell you today, we have a number of what I would call 50-year decisions that are being made at some very important installations in the Pacific. Here in Alaska, Tom Bergeson's dealing with about five of those, quite honestly. He's bedding down C-17, he's bedding down F-22, he's working the joint basing issues, he's moving Kulis from Stevens over, and he's standing up Red Flag Alaska and working with the folks up at Eielson to do that. And all of this has to come together in a coherent fashion for us to continue maintaining the combat capabilities that we need in the Pacific. The same is true in Hawaii in terms of the numbers of decisions, aren't quite so many. We're joint basing there, we're bedding down C-17, and we'll soon start to bed down the F-22. And of course, Guam is an interesting phenomena. We fought twice in our history from Guam, World War II, and we fought Vietnam. If we do this correctly, pardon me, I would submit to you that we will not have to fight from Anderson again. But it also provides us a power projection platform in the Pacific that is U.S. territory. So today, we're working joint basing issues at Guam with the Navy. We're bedding down the Global Hawk in what we call our ISR, Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance concept. And we're looking at the fact that 8,000 Marines may come off of Okinawa and go to Guam. So it's an interesting thing that's occurring on a place that has seen a sine wave of activity since the end of World War II, and I would tell you we're on the upslope now. We don't do anything in the Pacific, quite honestly, that is not based on a foundation of our relationship with the Japanese, a very, very important ally. A number of things going on with the Japanese as well, transforming that relationship, if you will. And the one example that I would use would be the fact that we're moving the Japanese Air Operations Center from its current base over to a co-located operations center with our United States Air Force at Yokota. There will be Japanese airmen sitting with American airmen controlling air power in that part of the Pacific. They have become, the Japanese, the JASDAF, have become our, frankly, number one ally in missile defense for the obvious reasons that we all understand. So that relationship continues to mature and continues to grow. The Republic of Korea, much the same way. That relationship, as we described earlier, is being morphed, if you will, from a Cold War relationship to one that more mirrors the realities of today and I think will be more useful for both nations in the future. I don't know anywhere in the Pacific where someone, if they do not necessarily want to be called your ally, want to be called your partner. And that goes all the way from India to Indonesia to Malaysia, Australia, Singapore, and I would even say Vietnam, which we have started some relationship as well. So, again, the drumbeat is we will not do anything. That's sort of a strong way to say it, but it's going to be very difficult to find a situation where we would go it alone in any particular scenario in the Pacific theater. The F-22 we've discussed. C-17s replaced the C-130s at Elmendorf. We've moved models of F-16s around. We moved the Block 30s to Eielson. Pardon me. And we replaced those on the Korean Peninsula with a squadron of Block 40s, which gives us a night all-weather capability on the peninsula. We've looked at the opportunity to bed down the F-35 at Eielson. We will actually do a site survey there and do all the environmental work. That basing will depend, frankly, on the number of airplanes we buy and how quickly we buy them. We have just parked the first wideband global SATCOM over the Pacific Theater. That's a program that we have worked with the Australians. That gives us a tenfold increase in our satellite comms capability in the Pacific, something that's been sorely needed and something that now postures us not just for satellite comms, but the ability to command and control Global Hawk and then download the tremendous amount of things that you are able to take off of that aircraft. Guam, we've talked a great deal about. The forces that came off the Republic of Korea, off of the Korean Peninsula, in large part went to Guam. So we've pretty much concluded that movement from an Air Force perspective. And what we've done is taken some of our heavy Red Horse engineering folks, our combat communicators, security forces, and the forces that open airfields for us, and we put them under one umbrella in a central location in the Pacific. So they will be able to respond anywhere we need them around the Pacific. It also provides a great training platform, so they are commanded. They live and work every day together, and it becomes much, much easier then for us to deploy those people. And they have done a great deal of work in terms of flooding in Bangladesh or just about any other natural disaster that you can think of. They were involved in Burma during the floods there as well, at least into Thailand, as far forward as we could get in an effort to help Burma do that. And we've talked a little bit, and that's all, by the way, done at Northwest Field, which is what that bullet means on the slide. We've talked a little bit about intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. That means Global Hawk. Three of those aircraft will be based on Guam with potential to base a fourth there. The hangars are under construction right now, and we hope by the end of this year, first part of next year, to get the first aircraft there. Your United States Air Force does three things for the nation and three things for the Joint Force, and that's global vigilance, global reach, and global power. We're up to our clavicles in the Pacific doing all three of those, quite honestly. Global Hawk being the newest addition. The tankers, from the Alaska perspective, are based with the guard unit at Eielson. We also have an active unit at Kadena, a guard unit which will soon be a guard and active unit combined at Hickam. And then we have a rotational force on Guam. Simply put, the United States Air Force needs a new tanker. We've been at the business of trying to get a tanker for several years now. The age of the tanker fleet in the Pacific averages 47 years. Those are Boeing 707s. We've re-engined the airplanes. We put them through depot periodically. I would tell you the depot folks do great work, but when it comes out, I don't have to tell this crowd, it's not a zero-hour aircraft when it comes out of the depot. So in the end, for every flying hour, it takes 7 hours of maintenance. That maintenance is, pardon me, done on the backs of the young men and women that we have on the flight line trying to do this work for us. So there's a plethora of reasons that we need a new tanker, but the bottom line is reliability, and I would tell you that range and payload is really the heart of what the United States Air Force does. The tanker is what allows us to do that, whether it be extending the range of transports, extending the range of humanitarian assistance, or frankly, extending the range of bombers and fighters. So you will see this start to play out as the new administration gets in the seat after the 20th of January. C-17 has done great work for us. It has been literally all over the world. The eight airplanes here and the eight airplanes at Hickam. Yesterday, when I left Hickam, we had two of those in the Middle East. So they do business everywhere in the world. They also do a lot of humanitarian work, and we talked about the Chinese. The Chinese lift before, that's not unusual. You will find that going on anywhere. There's a natural disaster, and PACOM has the need for us to do that. Today, there are six B-52s on Guam. That's a continuous rotation. I see that to continue as far as we can see into the future. We have F-22s from Langley deploying through Hickam on their way to Okinawa. The unit here at Elmendorf is preparing to leave for Guam. So you're starting to see that aircraft become a part of what we do every day here in the Pacific. Now, none of what we've talked about would be very effective without the appropriate command and control. We command and control air power principally from two main places in the Pacific, one being at Hickam and 13th Air Force for the entire Pacific with the exception of the Korean Peninsula, and there's a command and control facility on the Korean Peninsula there as well. That is something that the United States Air Force has dedicated itself to. It's something we vested in, and it's something that we will continue to do, and it's something that provides a tremendous capability for the Joint Force. For example, at Hickam, in the facility itself, we have an Army unit that does nothing but missile defense and air-based defense type work who is working for the Air Force commander there in the Air Operations Center. We have naval officers and enlisted people working there as well. So it's a tremendous joint effort in the facility out here, which is a scaled-down, smaller version that works the command and control portions of what goes on in Alaska. You obviously find Canadians, you find Americans, you find active duty and guard U.S. Air Force people working in that facility. We talked about promoting security and stability. I show you this slide only to show you the scope of what we do. unifying engagement seminars and places where we get together with action officers and senior leaders to discuss how we would get about solving humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, how we would get about dealing with terrorist situations in each other's countries, so you don't find yourself trading business cards necessarily at the scene of the accident, that you have the email address, that you know those individuals, and you've got the capability to talk back and forth. And I personally email back and forth with my counterparts in several of the countries around the Pacific. Alaska contributes a great deal to that with Red Flag Alaska, not only from the number of nations that come here to fly on the Alaska Range, but once a year we bring a number of their senior officers here to Elmendorf as well to give them a view of what goes on and also give us an opportunity to talk about things of mutual interest. As we talked before, we work military to military relations. We do a lot of bilateral things. We're continuing to work multilateral things as much as we can. And I'll close with this slide that talks just a little bit about our folks. There's 45,000 of us, active duty, guard, and reservist. Typically, every day, we'll have about 2,000 people from the Pacific Air Forces deployed around the world, and typically about 1,800 of those will be to the Middle East, doing some particular duty in Iraq or Afghanistan. We also have about 6,800 people, and I use the word deployed on the Korean Peninsula because 90% of them are there without their families on a one-year remote tour. And it is, as I said before, a total force integration. We are very fortunate in this theater with the relationship that we have, our relationship with the adjutant generals, not just Craig Campbell here in the state of Alaska, but the other adjutant generals from Hawaii and Guam as well. For those of you in the business world, I had to put the smart operations pitch on there. We're into process improvement like the rest of you. Our budget's not going to get any bigger. It's as simple as that. We've given our folks a clean sheet of paper to tell us how to do things better. Now, that doesn't mean we erase all the regulations and the supervision. We tried that once under TQM, and it didn't work real well for us. But I would tell you that we've gotten a tremendous response. When we sat down to start this program, the secretary at the time had a name that he laid on the table, and I had to say, you know, Mr. Secretary, you're really married to that particular name because the captains are going to have a great time with that. Why don't we say something about how smart it is, because even a captain can't argue with a program that talks about being smart. So in the end, it became Air Force Smart Operations 21. We've been at this now for about 4 years, and we've made some progress. And for the size of the organization and the things that we're trying to do, the progress has not been bad. And you'll find the whole Department of Defense is involved in this as well. Air Force recruiting, good news story. We're getting some great young men and women. We are not lowering the standards, by the way, in terms of the young men and women that we're recruiting. The standards today are the same as the standards that they've been in the past. So we're very fortunate to be able to say that, but we try to solve that recruiting problem by retention. We still recruit airmen and retain their families, and retention has been very, very good. We're very fortunate, and this is in the aggregate we're meeting our retention goals. I will tell you there are some spots where we have issues, and it's typically in the mid-level NCO area that you would expect in those high-stress career fields that have to do with heavy construction, security forces, explosive ordnance disposal, and those kinds of things that are under a fair amount of pressure supporting what's going on in the global war on terror in the Central Command AOR. In the aggregate, in the Pacific, we tend to do a little better than the rest of the Air Force. I like to think it's because people are out here actually doing the job that we've trained them to do for the most part. I won't lie to you. They've also got what we call a DROS, a return from overseas. So you can't necessarily get out when you're over here in the Pacific. You have to wait till you go home, so we have a little bit of that advantage as well. But in the main, our statistics stack up very favorably with what goes on in the rest of the Air Force, and it's not only because people are doing the job that they've been trained to do, but again, I would thank you for making them feel at home in places like Alaska as well as Hawaii and the other places that we put them in the Pacific. It truly is a great place to be assigned. I find myself completing my 12th year at some point in time in and out of the Pacific theater. So I personally enjoy it, and I find it to be very rewarding, and I hope people do the same. I would leave you with these takeaways. You know, we're not at war in the Pacific, and I've tried to explain why at least one person thinks we're not at war in the Pacific, but we're not completely at peace. There are those that would deny access to us in places in the Pacific. The Chinese work very hard at carving out their place in the Pacific. The Russian resurgence that we've seen is of great interest to a lot of people. We're still dealing with terrorism in the Philippines. So it's a place where we continue to remain vigilant and we continue to maintain the presence we need for the influence that we need and the capabilities we need in the Pacific. We live with six of the world's largest armed forces in this part of the world, so there's bound to be a little bit of friction when you do that. So we need to continue to work those military-to-military relationships that we work every day. The high-end competition that we look at out here in the Pacific is getting good. They've gone to school on what your United States Air Force has done and what we can do. They learn a lot from us. They continue to get better, and we'll continue to get better as well. But we need to maintain our high-end capabilities, and as we maintain those, we're having to basically conduct a war on the low end in terms of low-end operations. Some say if you've got your toolkit full of high-end capabilities, you can do the low-end things. That's true to a point, quite honestly. But at the same time, there's a very delicate balance between training to do high-end operations, whether you're in the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force, and conducting low-end operations. We've talked a little bit about the strategic triangle and how critical that will continue to be to security and stability in the Pacific. And if I haven't said it enough today, I'll say it one more time. The persistent involvement that we have in the Pacific today is very, very important to what we do, at least in the United States military. So let me close with that, and I think that probably leaves us plenty of time for questions.
You've been listening to General Howie Chandler, speaking on executing air, space, and cyber power to fly, fight, and win in the Pacific. Recorded on Friday, January 9th, 2009 in Anchorage, Alaska. Following his talk, General Chandler responded to questions from the audience. First, an audience member asked the general to give him confidence in our satellite systems. The questioner expressed concern, asking, are U.S. forces more vulnerable with these satellites in place? Secondly, he wanted to know about the likelihood of an electromagnetic bomb exploding along U.S. coastline and where U.S. forces currently stand in the case that one was dropped in the Pacific.
Let me take the first one first, and let me lump cyber and space in it together, because they're both going to be contested, whether we like it or not. The folks at Strat Command, Strategic Command in Omaha, spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we're going to defend not only space capabilities, but cyber capabilities as well. A lot of work in that area. Not the answer I would like to give you, but other people are just as vulnerable as we are. That's not a good solution, quite honestly. But nobody has broken this code yet on defending, although a lot of people are working on being able to deny those capabilities. We've seen the Chinese do it in a rather clumsy fashion. We've seen the United States do it in a rather surgical fashion when we knocked down a satellite that was basically going to end up in a place could have ended up in a place where we didn't want it to go. I don't know that I'm going to be able to make you feel real good, other than to tell you that we've got a fairly robust capability to begin with, and we're working very hard on how we have enough space situational awareness to know what's going on around our capabilities. That's the first problem. And how you have enough cyber awareness to know what's going on in your cyber networks. And then how do we get about defending those? The gig, as we call it, which is our our secure and non-secure network, is more secure than the commercial world that we live in today when we stick our credit card in the gas pump. That, to me, I think the Russian ambassador was here, and you probably talked a lot about what went on in their last incursion. That was preceded by a cyber attack that was very well done. So we know those capabilities are out there. I'm not going to be able to make you probably feel as good as you want to feel, to be honest about it. But it's an issue that's not... Let me put it this way. There are a lot of people worried about it that are wearing a uniform, too, that are working the issue. And we've had some interaction with the corporate world, too. On some of these things, and I can't go into a lot of that, But there's, you know, from a money perspective and others, the corporate world is working on that part as well. Now, the electromagnetic thing, I'm not sure what's driving the electromagnetic. If it's a specific threat of that type, I'm not sure I've got a good answer for you either. But I would be more concerned about the dirty bomb business and how perhaps easy that would be. And again, the Coast Guard is working that problem very hard about how we actually defend ports or defend the coasts. But maritime protection has jumped to the forefront in terms of NORTHCOM as I look at what NORTHCOM is doing. And that's particularly true here, obviously, because there's a lot of traffic through the Aleutians. I mean, you know, if this is the crossroads of the world for air, then it would make sense that on the ocean surface, you've got a lot of that traffic too. So maritime awareness is a big deal as well.
Next, an audience member asked, would increasing joint operations with the Japanese, as the general mentioned in his speech, permit the possibility of stationing fewer troops in Japan? Do you see an opportunity of drawing down U.S. troops in Japan? He asked.
Yeah, the Kadena hasn't been as controversial as Fatenma. And part of the Marine Corps, well, the entire Marine Corps move to Guam is hinged on a replacement in the Japanese government replacing the Fatenma airfield further north on the island. Kadena has pretty well been accepted there. We work noise issues very hard, but we work those noise issues around all the installations in Japan as well. And we work that with the Japanese government and the Air Self-Defense Force. I don't know how much more drawdown we would do there. I mean, we don't call Kadena the keystone of the Pacific for nothing. So we've gone from 3 to 2 fighter squadrons on that particular installation. The Marines, I think, they have a difficulty with training areas and other things. The northern end of the island has become tremendously populated and it's growing. There's no reason we can't move out of that and move further north. So I would tell you that rather than off the island, different positions on the island and then the movement to Guam, I think, would probably help that scenario more than reducing what goes on at Kadena Air Base.
Next, another audience member asked, is there any military reason why the United States Air Force should not get another Boeing air tanker? He also asked the general to talk about the increasing presence of the Chinese naval power.
Yeah. I may not be able to help you much with the Chinese naval power. I can talk a little bit about the Air Force and a little bit about the Navy. There are two competitors in the tanker business right now. One is Northrop Grumman. One is Boeing. We made a down select at one point in time. The contract was protested, which, by the way, is not unusual, because today there are fewer and fewer large defense contracts. So it's incumbent upon us to try to make the process work and do it as fairly and openly as we can. The tanker competition, in my time working in the Pentagon, and I was there through the whole thing, is probably the most open competition that we have ever had in terms of Air Force requirements and acquisition. So we are where we are. I now have left the Pentagon. I find myself in an operational assignment, and I would tell you, from an operational perspective, we just need a new tanker. It's as simple as that. And then we need to buy it in enough numbers and quickly enough so that the 47-year-old KC-135s on the ramp today are replaced so they're not 60 years old or 70 years old before we get around to replacing all 500, because there are 500 of those aircraft. And I would tell you, we use all 500 of them. Without that capability, you don't fly nonstop from, well, let me just give an example. You don't take wounded soldiers out of Ramstein or if they are badly enough hurt out of Balad in the Middle East and fly them nonstop to Walter Reed. You don't do it without tankers. The Chinese have made some very smart military investments. Quiet submarine technology is a concern because we rely on aircraft carriers and other things in the Western Pacific. They're also working weaponry that would deny access for aircraft carriers in the Western Pacific in terms of missile technology. But I would tell you they're also working as hard as they can on things that would counter air capabilities. They have not got nearly the same technology that we have in the F-22, to be honest about it. We need to buy the F-22 in enough numbers to matter. You get to the point where no matter how good the capabilities are, in order to maintain the presence you need a certain amount of numbers to make that work. That number remains to be seen. The new administration will begin to work that, too, as soon as they come on board. So smart military investments, some would ask, if it's only Taiwan you're worried about, why all of this investment? I mean, that's sort of the question we ask. So then the problem becomes, how do we get to the point where we understand why and what and the whys and wherefores to the point where we understand each other's capabilities so we do not miscalculate or misunderstand? And that's really the thrust of what goes on here in this military relationship. How do we get to the point where we don't miscalculate or we don't misunderstand? That, and thank you for your comment. I will pass that on to the young men and women that do the hard work. I get to talk to PowerPoint slides all day.
Many of us in this country think the greatest threat to the United States is the threat of internal economic collapse, an audience member stated. Particularly in talking about the tanker, it does not seem as though your talk, he told the general, has taken the implications of the global economic crisis into account. How do you plan to do so in the future, he asked.
Well, there, you know, I think I was being optimistic when I said the budget, military budget, will not increase. Realistically, when you look at it, you understand that we cannot continue the supplementals and the budget process that we have today. First of all, it's makes no sense to us trying to spend money in terms of the supplemental process today. Supplementals and a foundational budget, and I'll give you the number, and we can debate it, of about 4% of GDP is what we think we need to do the job. Now, the question then becomes, will the economy bear that, given the situation that we're in? And we'll have that debate. Don't know. But you're exactly right. We see a shifting in priorities as to where some of these dollars are going to go. Now, what you then need to ask yourself is, where do we want to be in the world? Because assuming the budget comes down enough, and we were on the track at one point in time to take about 50,000 people out of the Air Force. That was because people are our biggest cost, like most business. What we found was the cost of other things ate up the effort to decrease people to then do the recapitalization. So there was an effort at one point to do that internally in the Air Force and say, we can recapitalize the things we need in the Air Force by simply reducing the force. We think we can do that. Frankly, I think we could. We've stopped the drawdown at 330,000 airmen now, as opposed to going down lower than we were going to go, because frankly, we weren't getting where we were going to get and try to get to, and some of the things that we looked at in terms of efficiencies weren't panning out the way they needed to pan out. Good example was the tremendous growth in unmanned aerial systems. They're not unmanned. Somebody has to fix them. Somebody has to fly them. So when you look at it from that perspective, that was the Air Force approach to recapitalization. But there is, I mean, those of us that have worked in the building and work at the senior levels in the services understand very well that our budget is not only not going to get bigger, but we're all going to have to contribute to what goes on in terms of fixing the economy. So what's the best way to do that? I don't necessarily know that the tanker model does that. I mean, you could maybe say that about the F-22 model. The important thing to us is the technology and how we maintain a technology base. And if you close the F-22 line, then you have no fifth generation stealth fighter line production capability. You don't employ those people. So what do they go do? They'll find other work. how do you then get them back if you want to work that business? So simply having the line open was important to us in terms of the F-22. Now, whether or not it fits into the big scheme of things will be the debate that is had in the new administration. But you're right. I don't think you can argue with the tanker recapitalization. And in large part, because it's built on commercial airframes, it does fit the model that you're talking about. That's probably not the best answer to your question, but it's the only one I've got.
Lastly, what is the future for the B-52 fighter planes being used in the United States Air Force? Another audience member asked.
The B-52 is going to be with us a while. I mean, it's a great truck. Carries a lot of bombs. You can do a lot of things with it, particularly in an environment where nobody's shooting back at you, which is the case we're in Afghanistan and Iraq for the most part. And that airplane has evolved from a low-altitude bomber meant to fly at low altitude into the Soviet Union to drop nuclear weapons to one that now orbits over Army units working with a ground controller dropping precision munitions into enemy foxholes. I mean, I suppose that's why I enjoy being in the Air Force, because it is so adaptive. And if you use your gray matter, you can make these things work to your advantage in just about any scenario. So what are you asking me if we'll ever stop putting people in fighters? Is that what you're asking? No, I don't think so. And you know, that's easy for me to say, and everybody will go, well, yeah, that's because that's what you do. But I would tell you that, you know, I don't agree with the argument that there are some places where you don't send people because the environment's too bad. There are places where we don't want to send people because the environment's too bad. But I will give you Vietnam as an example where we flew into whatever we had to fly into to do the job. Now, if you can find a better way, that's a good thing. But I would tell you, I think we're always going to have a mix of some variety. But I will also tell you that the unmanned aerial systems that we're flying today are really the right flyers of UAS. The Predator, someday you will look at as a Wright flyer-like machine. These systems will develop quickly. They will become very good at what they do, and we will have more options then to not put people in harm's way as we do it. But at the same time, I think there's always something to be said for having a mix of some kind as you do it, because there's nothing like putting eyes on something when you really, really need to do it. So I think we're going to have ways to help ourselves in a lot of respects. But at the same time, I think there's always going to be a need for manned aviation of some kind. So we'll still be producing people with wings. How we do it is going to change because of simulation and some of the things that we can do today that we could not do in the past. So how we produce a pilot will be different, and it should be. We shouldn't be producing pilots today the way we did after World War II. We shouldn't be doing it. But I think you're always going to find a need for somebody that understands aviation to be in the air at some point at some time. Did that answer your question? Okay. Good. Thank you.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents An Airman's Perspective with General Howie Chandler. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk on executing air, space, and cyber power to fly, fight, and win in the Pacific, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, January 9th, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.